welcome to It's About Florida. We have here with us President Don Gates. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for coming in. It's a pleasure to talk with you again.
Wonderful. So you all have been really busy these first 2 weeks. Talk about the pace of this session, because, again, it's much faster than we've seen in years past.
Well, I think thanks to Speaker Will Weatherford and our Rules Chair, John Thrasher, here in the Senate, we've developed a pace both in the House and the Senate that's going to move bills that are important through the process. But not every bill that gets introduced gets passed, thank goodness. But the good thing is, and I say this as somebody who doesn't believe in more bills meaning better government, thank goodness we have about 35% less proposed legislation than we did in previous years. We have about 875 bills filed in the Senate. That's about a third less than last year and normal. So that's good. We got bills referenced faster. We got them to committee chairs quicker. And committee chairs are moving the bills forward, I think, in a thoughtful and deliberate way so everybody gets a chance to ask questions, but not delaying bills or sitting on them, including controversial bills that sometimes divides people based on their own beliefs or what they think is best for the state of Florida. But I believe in the debate. I believe in allowing controversial issues to come forward and dealing with them and giving people on all sides a chance to be heard. And it appears we're doing that.
Probably one of the most controversial issues you guys have taken up was, should Florida expand Medicaid under the federal health care law? Would you have gone forward, if it was just up to you, would you have gone forward with the traditional expansion?
I was very skeptical of it. I've spent about 30 years in health care myself, not as a clinician, but as somebody who's developed and organized and administered health care.
You have a business, right? A long-term care?
Well, I was in the business of providing hospice care across the United States for about 25 years. We sold that business in 2004. I still have my finger in a couple of healthcare-related things, but they're not large businesses. But I can tell you, as somebody who's been a hospital administrator and who's run a national healthcare company, that Medicaid, traditional Medicaid, is not exactly the favorite of patients, because they have a hard time actually getting people to see them if they have Medicaid cards. Medicaid is almost looked on as a step-down form of payment. Providers don't like it because there's not adequate payment to cover the costs. Taxpayers don't like Medicaid because it's metastatic. It's bad, it grows, it seems to eat up the rest of the budget and crowd out education and other issues. So expanding traditional Medicaid as we know it, a failed system, is probably something that that wouldn't have been a good idea. I would have been skeptical of it. Instead, I think that Senator Negron and Senator Bean are working on alternatives. And Representative Corcoran over in the House of Representatives is working on an alternative as well that would really allow people to buy into the private health care system. If we can provide assistance to folks to buy into the private health care system at less cost, with them having some responsibility for healthy habits, with them having some co-pays so that they have a little bit of skin in the game when they go to the doctor, I think that's a whole lot better system than expanding something that providers and patients and taxpayers don't like.
Let me ask you this question, because when Senator Negron's plan was announced, and that would be to basically allow more people into the kid care program to expand that, there was some criticism, and the criticism was, well, we're just expanding Medicaid anyway because we're going to try and tap into these federal dollars. We're just not calling it that.
Senator Negron's approach, as he has defined it so far, is very different from traditional Medicaid. Under traditional Medicaid, there is no skin in the game for beneficiaries. There is no copay. Nobody has to come out of pocket for anything. But that's not the case in what Senator Negron has in mind. He wants to at least have a modest copay, so that would encourage the use of primary care as opposed to using the emergency room for a doctor's office. Secondly, Senator Negron's bill would provide incentives for people to have healthy habits. And when you ask your friends and neighbors to contribute to your health care costs, then it seems to me that it's incumbent on you to at least try to have healthy habits so you mitigate unnecessary costs. That's not the case under traditional Medicaid. Under traditional Medicaid, there is just a host of covered services that you get whether you need them or not. Under Senator Negron's proposal, he's saying, let's provide a classification of services that most people need, but let's not provide and pay for and put taxpayers on the hook for services that people don't necessarily need. So there's a host of differences between what Senator Negron is talking about and traditional Medicaid. Also, it would be less expensive for the taxpayers. So I think there are a lot of choices here, and those who would say that there's only one way to do it, and that's the way that was originally enshrined in PPACA or Obamacare, I think they're wrong. I think states are pushing hard to try to have some flexibility. We really do need a Florida plan that works for Floridians, not just a plan that's hatched in Washington that's a one-size-fits-all for everybody in this country.
The last time that I sat down in your office, we had a really long talk about career and professional education. Mm-hmm. And it just so happens we have the Career and Professional, or CAPE Act.
Right.
And when I read it, it looks like we're trying to bring back the tracking system of old. And is that what we're talking about here, where it's called Pathways now, but it seems really similar to that old tracking system?
Absolutely not. And we're not calling it tracking because it's not tracking. Instead, we really want to keep options open. What happens is that students are able to earn three credentials at once. The first is a high school diploma, but the second is national industry certifications in career fields that really relate to the economy, like culinary arts or information technology, construction, aerospace. But third, and most importantly, they're able to earn college credits that are fully paid for. My dream is, and I've seen this happen in my own school district when I was superintendent in Okaloosa, students walk across the high school graduation stage, and they get national industry certifications credentialing these students. And studies that have come out as recently as this week indicate that graduates with national industry certifications, they're getting pay that's substantially larger, 50, 60, 70% higher than students who just have an associate's degree or a bachelor's degree even. You've got a college or university official on that graduation stage next to the industry folks, and they're handing out college credits that are earned at the same time in the same courses. And then I was standing there as a superintendent of schools handing out the least valuable credential, the high school diploma, because a high school diploma without any kind of skills is Confederate money. It really doesn't work in the economy today.
But it still seems like the concept is there, creating different, ways for students to achieve that high school diploma.
Well, yeah, I think that you have to understand that the students are different. Mm-hmm. And one of the failings, I think, of our 1950s, 1960s style of education that we still use is assuming that everybody learns the same way, and everybody ought to be on the same page of the same book at the same time and lift their left leg at the same time all over the state of Florida or all over the United States. And that's just not real. Students learn in a different way, and they learn at a different pace. And so what the CAPE bill that Senator Legge is sponsoring will do is to say, look, if you've got a student whose aptitude is to understand concepts based on tangible application. Take geometry. You can teach geometric theory on a chalkboard, or you can teach it by calculating the risers on a stair step or how to build a corner cabinet. Either way, you arrive at the same place in terms of a student being able to understand and then apply the principles of geometry. What we've done is to give out the false impression that there's only one way to learn it, and that's the chalkboard method, and that everybody's going to college, when in fact most students are not going to complete a four-year degree, and if they do, many of them, and President Obama even acknowledged, mm-hmm. half of last year's college graduation classes across the United States are unemployed today, or they're underemployed.
A quarter of students are completing high school, but they're not getting diplomas. They're getting certificates of completion or, you know, other alternatives. And I'm curious if anyone has looked at the CAPE Act proposal and, you know, how would it impact that quarter of students who go to school every day, but maybe they can't pass the FCAT, or maybe they may not be able to pass the new Common Core standards?
Well, let's make it clear that when I'm talking about career technical education, when I'm talking about Senator Legge's CAPE Act, I'm not talking about a step-down or a dumbed-down curriculum.
Which is something we've heard over in the House when that bill came out. A lot of people were railing about that.
Yeah, well, it's not a step-down or dumbed-down curriculum. We don't want it, and we don't need it. Instead, what we need to do, as I said, is to look at how individual students learn and then adapt our teaching methods to how they learn so that we can reach them where they are. If you can reach a student, if you can touch their aptitude or their interest, they're less likely to drop out. They're more likely to actually earn a diploma. Or if they're in college, they're more likely to finish and actually get a degree, and the degree is more likely to be able to be actually used in the job market. So is this a magic bullet that's going to end high school dropouts or make sure that we don't have a large number of students who complete, in quotes, but don't get a high school diploma? I don't think it's a silver bullet. But will it reach more students and make it more likely that more students will have a high school or college education that's relevant to the job market and also academically rigorous? Well, we found that to be true in Okaloosa County, and we think it's going to be true across Florida.
Teach to their interests.
Yeah, well, teach to their aptitudes as well and to their skill level.
Florida is in the middle of what has been a pretty rocky transition to national education standards called the Common Core. And I'm curious to know, you know, what do you think? Is Florida ready for this, given some of the things that we've already seen?
Well, here's the hard truth. The hard truth is that we lost time. The Department of Education treaded water for more than a year in not really getting ready for Common Core standards and not making sure that our school districts got the technical assistance, the help they needed, the inclusion that they wanted in the decision making. So we lost time. Now, do we just write that off and say, well, you know, those kids just lose those years? Or do we try to accelerate within the Department of Education and within our school districts to make sure that we're ready? You know, our students have to compete, whether it's for jobs or college admission or anything else, with students across the United States and across the world. Common Core standards means that we will measure ourselves against the rest of the United States and the rest of the world, ultimately. I think we've got to get about the business of doing it. Shame on the Department of Education, and shame on those who didn't step up and get the job done. But I don't think we wait around for another 2 or 3 years. I think we try to accelerate our efforts.
You're listening to It's About Florida. We've been talking with Florida Senate President Don Gates, and now back to our conversation.
I know you pointed to the issue of teacher training and the trickle-down, but we've had even some legislative budget steps. I think a year before last, one of the Big Bend organization that does a lot of the training got zeroed out of the budget, you know, so that kind of set us back.
Actually, they didn't get zeroed out of the budget. The governor vetoed them. Yeah, the legislature appropriated the money. I voted for the money. Mm-hmm. I know the organization pretty well, but the governor vetoed it. So I think sometimes the governor and the legislature look at things differently. But I believe that if you're going to expect teachers or schools or school districts to lift their game, then you have to provide the technical assistance to show them how. Otherwise, you simply create failure. you invent failure. And frankly, that's what we did for about a year and a half over at the Florida Department of Education. It isn't always about, you know, appropriating more money and then magically good things happen. It's about targeting resources and technical assistance to help people who need help.
Will teachers get any kind of a pay raise this year?
I hope so. As a superintendent of schools, I did everything I could to reduce overhead and move more money into teachers' pay envelopes. Mm-hmm. I couldn't do as much as I wanted to do, but I think in 6 years I was superintendent, we probably had some record pay increases. So I hope teachers will get more pay this year. I agree with the governor that during the time when this governor came into office and the state was in a tailspin, he had to ask for and expect sacrifices from a lot of folks. And so teachers who may have expected pay raises didn't get them. They might have gotten what are called step raises, annual raises, but they didn't get raises above that. Our state workers didn't get any raise. They didn't get any step. But, yeah, I hope that teachers will get a pay raise. And my hope is that teacher pay raises will be tied to student achievement and performance as much as possible. I don't believe in across-the-board raises that take the place of performance raises.
Because that's what the governor has proposed. The governor has proposed an across-the-board pay increase. I was listening in at the State Board of Education, and they, too, were expressing concern about across-the-board increases versus performance-based increases. So is that what you're advocating, purely performance?
Well, look at it this way. Compare state workers and then teachers. Not every teacher, but many teachers in many school districts across this state over the last 6 years received what are called step increases, meaning they got a pay raise that was an annual pay raise tied in some way to the cost of living. Now, sometimes teachers' unions don't call a step raise a raise, but where I come from, if your pay envelope gets fatter, that's called a raise. On the other hand, state workers have had no raises of any kind for 6 years unless they have gotten a promotion to a different job. Mm-hmm. So I think state workers deserve to have an across-the-board pay raise. And then if we can create a performance pay system on top of that, I'm all about it. I believe in performance pay. But state workers have gone for 6 years without a pay raise. They deserve a pay raise, and this Senate is going to try to give them a pay raise. Since the state has committed itself in statute to recognizing and rewarding effective teaching, when are we going to fund it? When are we going to fund what we say we believe in? We say we believe that if a teacher comes early, stays late, takes on struggling students, you know, works extra hard, helps kids who might be behind, might even, you know, have learning disabilities, achieve some sort of measurable gains against the odds, we've said we're going to recognize and reward those teachers. Well, when are we going to start sending them some money instead of just some words? I think this is the time to do it.
The teacher evaluation system that we have now, 90-some-odd percent, I think 96% of teachers were effective and highly effective. But yet there are still questions related to kind of the method of measure that DOE uses to calculate those student learning gains. There have been questions that model is flawed. And so I'm curious to know if the legislature is planning to revamp that model, and if so, how?
I'll tell you, there are times when I believe that building just ought to be sold for commercial real estate. I will tell you this, that I think the Department of Education overcomplicated the pay-for-performance system that the legislature adopted. I've never been able to get a clear explanation for teachers that teachers could really grasp and understand and apply as to how the Department of Education was implementing Senate Bill 736. I think they overcomplicated it. And so, therefore, I would agree that teachers should not be judged based on the students they don't have. I think when you have too many variables and too many ingredients in a formula, it's not only impossible to understand, but it also, you lose credibility if it's something that can't be simply explained. If you can't explain how you're doing pay for performance, at a school advisory council meeting or a PTO meeting or at the kitchen table, then it's way too complicated. So what I would favor would be a system that would simply recognize and reward teachers based on the learning gains of the students they teach. Now, learning gains are not just calculated based on the FCAT. Learning gains can also be calculated in other ways. There are other valid and reliable measures of performance. And also there are other metrics of student achievement that we can use to determine whether students, by the end of a year, have progressed compared to where they were at the beginning of the year. Let's start recognizing those teachers who we can recognize and then provide them with some kind of reward for their sacrifices. And I think it ought to be a very simple system based on learning gains and other metrics of student achievement. And let's go ahead and do it. It doesn't have to be complicated, but if we don't do it now, if we roll back the clock now and say we just can't figure out a way to recognize and reward teachers who sacrifice and achieve results, then I think that we'll lose the momentum for the future to be able to attract great teachers.
When session first began, it looked like the House and Senate were pretty far away on a couple of key bills, ethics reform and campaign finance specifically. I think last week the House revised down some of its campaign contribution limits from $10,000 down to $5,000. Where are we now in this process? How close are you all to compromising on some of these things?
Well, I guess I would take maybe a little different view. I don't think that Speaker Weatherford and I were very far apart at all. I think we were in agreement as to what we wanted to achieve, and I think the ethics bill that unanimously passed the Senate, every Democrat, every Republican voting for it, is a bill which enshrines the goals and principles that Speaker Weatherford and I both have. I think you're talking now about campaign finance reform and details like, well, what's going to be the maximum allowable contribution? Mm-hmm. Well, the goal we're trying to achieve here is more transparency and trying to have a system where campaign dollars are really spent in campaigns and less money, if we can make it happen, no money is diverted into funds that can be used for subsidizing somebody's lifestyle. So the objective is what I'm after. I'm less interested in whether or not the campaign finance limit for an individual contribution is $500 or $1,000, and I'm more interested in making sure that we have transparency in reporting and that campaign dollars can't be diverted for use by politicians to subsidize their lifestyles instead of using it for the purposes the donors intended it, and that is to advance causes, beliefs, and candidacies.
And as I prepare to leave you, you all still have several weeks up here. Any final thoughts as you move forward?
Well, the big thing we have to do, that which is required by the Constitution, is to pass a budget. I am confident that we're going to be able to achieve a budget this year that will be balanced, unlike Washington. That will I think you will see a bipartisan support for the budget as it goes through the process of committees, unlike Washington. And I also think that the critical needs of the people of Florida in education and health care and law enforcement, the environment, economic development, are being looked at very, very seriously. We have a little bit more revenue than we had in the past. And, of course, people have mentally spent that money 20 or 30 times. Somebody came in here yesterday and told me, some lobbyist said, well, there's over $4 billion in new money. You know, so there are people who have all kinds of fanciful ideas about what's happening. But we have a little bit more revenue, and I think we have we've gone through a serious, intensive budget process in the Senate to look at those things that may have been baked into the budget in the 80s and 90s, that maybe have been overtaken by events, and now there are things that are more important than that tax incentive that we provided to somebody back in 1982 that's still baked into the budget. So there's an intensive budget review that has led us, I think, to prioritize what's important And I think there's a willingness to cooperate on both sides of the aisle and both sides of the Capitol. There'll be serious disagreements. There'll be fierce debates. That's the way the process ought to work. But at the end of the day, we're going to have a balanced budget, and we're going to do what Washington can't do. We're going to run the government.
Well, Senate President Gates, thank you so much for joining us here today on It's About Florida.
Thanks so much. Great to be with you.
Thanks again to Senate President Don Gates. You've been listening to What's About Florida, a production of WFSU-FM. I'm Lynn Hatter. Ryan Bank and Taylor Cox provided technical assistance. Please join us again next week for more discussion on the issues impacting our state.